Full pastures of Wakefield, Quebec. For the first time ever, Suoni Paralpopolo presents a day of revelatory offerings in an historic farmhouse, Fairburn House, bordering the Gatineau River in Wakefield. Saturday, June 25th, music begins at 3:30 p.m. On the bill, Suoni Heartstoppers Esmarine, Willie Mitchell, Nada El Shazly, and Eliza Caution. For tickets, directions, camping, and all the 411, go to suoniparalpopolo.org. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
CKUT, CKUT 90.3 FM.
What's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. We have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
I will be one of the greatest, that is a vow, yeah, that is a promise. Always wanted to be famous, just being real, yeah, just being honest. My haters won't always be nameless, give them no clout, I give them no power. Creators built different, they ancient, sooner than later, all will be ours. I keep an eye out for the numbers, I stay in contact, synchronization. To infinity, even beyond it, I am a common, no destination. A lot of things I am above, and there are a lot of things that are above me. Do not come for the people I love, cause then I get scary, then I get uglier. Ain't no problem when I'm the equation. Presence, noted, observation. I'm not new here, reborn creation.
Yes, we're back. It's another Tuesday evening, and you are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and this month is dedicated to Black Fathers. Father's Day happens in June, and this month I wanted to give the platform to a variety of Black Fathers at different stages of fatherhood. Tonight's guest, his name is Cedric Charles Titus. He was born in Montreal to Haitian parents, and at 36 years old, he is married and is the proud father of a beautiful baby girl born this past January. Cedric grew up in Aylmer, a small city close to Ottawa, currently known as Gatineau. Then he moved back to Montreal for school. Having completed his studies at HEC Montreal, he is currently working as a senior business analyst for TELUS. Cedric is a big fan of football, the one that you actually play with your feet, and used to play for the Outremont Football Club. With a fascination for the martial arts, he enjoys watching the UFC, boxing, and kung fu movies. In his spare time, he also pursues a deep passion for completing do-it-yourself projects and woodworking. To sum it up, Cedric is just a regular dude doing his best to enjoy life as he should. Cedric, thank you so much for being here, man. I'm super excited about having our conversation because you're a new dad. Yep. And I wanted to make sure that we had a new father, like, to get that perspective as well, because my first guest, he turned 50 this year, and he has like 6 kids, and my second guest is an older man with an older kid, like his son is like in his mid-20s. Well, I definitely wanted to have, you know, a younger perspective of what I call a quote-unquote young father, and like, young father doesn't mean that your age is young. It means that your child is young. Your first child is young. So I wanted to have your perspective as well. How are you doing, man? It's been an unusual couple of years. And you had the baby. You had a pandemic baby, you know.
Yeah.
And apparently pandemic babies have superpowers. So we'll get into that a little bit later on. But and then I spoke to your wife for Black Mother's Month. So we know a little bit of her side of the story and a little bit of what happened with her, like, from her perspective, but we want to get your perspective. How has this pandemic been? for you?
I think it's been interesting. You know, like pre-pandemic, I was already working from home. So, when the pandemic hit, like at first it wasn't such a big deal, right? Because I was already home all the time, pretty much. And on top of that, I'm slightly antisocial, so it's not like, you know, I was going out to different places and stuff. I was pretty much staying home, seeing families. You know, if I would go out, it would be to like small gatherings and stuff. So
gotcha. So when the pandemic hit, not much changed for you.
Not at first, no.
But also,
actually, I was pretty happy about it because now I had an excuse to stay home.
Right. But also, that year for you was pretty big. I mean, you got married in January. In Trinidad and Tobago, and then 3 months later, it's like everything is on lockdown because. If I remember, we're friends. I remember correctly, you guys wanted to have like a second celebration in Montreal as well.
Yes.
Or something indeed. To that effect. So that all got canceled.
Yeah, we had to cancel that. Yeah. But yeah, actually, even before we could even get to the actual planning part, like it was obvious that it was not going to happen this year.
Okay.
And then the hope was that, okay, well, maybe next year when we're done with all this the stuff, but COVID just has a way to come back and bite you. So
yeah,
here we are.
Yeah, indeed. So throughout the pandemic, you're working from home, and like I said, we spoke to your wife, so I know a bit of the tea, but our audience members might want to hear your perspective. You both had actually gotten pregnant in the beginning of the pandemic, and you were expecting a first baby before your current baby. Could you tell us a little bit about that experience, finding out that she was pregnant, and then things that happened afterwards?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Like to your point, like you said, we got married in January, right before the pandemic started to hit. And so the plan was that we're gonna wait a year and then get busy to try to make that baby. I mean, so you know, like we had a year to practice, and then
I like that,
you know, and then it started for real.
Right.
And then, yeah. What can I say? The seed is strong. So, you know, she got pregnant, and then it was basically exactly what I wanted. We were like kind of following the plan that we had set out for ourselves.
Yeah. Right?
So everything was kind of falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
And then tragedy hit. She had a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And then we obviously lost a baby.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm not sure exactly how my wife told the story, but
that's okay. We want the husband side of the story.
You want the husband side.
Yeah, because honestly, these are the kind of things that happen in our community, in the Black community, and we don't often hear men talking about it, like how they're feeling, like what was going through their mind, you know, like, so that's what we want to get your side of the story, essentially.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay.
Like,
so
before we get to the tragedy, like when you found out, okay, that she was pregnant, like what was that like for you on an emotional level? Like, let me ask you, like, how important is fatherhood to you?
It's very important. This is, and you see, like growing up, and even as a young adult, I always had this vision of how I was going to be a father to my son myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to my son because that'll be important later on to understand.
Yeah, of course.
And every time I had an occasion to witness fatherhood, I always had this, you know, this note back on the back of my mind saying like, okay, so I see how it's done. Like, this is how I'm going to do it, and this is what I will do. And you know, if my son has the, you know, has this type of talent or this type of aptitude, this is how I want to push him into, you know, realizing his true potential and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you know, with the vision of building that strong relationship where, you know, we know that we're like partners for life, and then, you know, this is kind of the vision that I have of it.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, when you know, she gave me the news that she was pregnant and everything, I was super happy. And I even wanted to create like a specific memory about it.
Okay.
So I told her, okay, all right, you go back in the bathroom, right, with the test results, and I'm gonna start the Lion King music, and then come out and then record the thing, and then I'm recording it at the same time, and then we can share this video with everyone. So
that's beautiful.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Like, I had this whole vision about how it was supposed to happen and everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, everything was like kind of falling into plan. And then so, you know, calling everybody, hey, you know, grandma is pregnant, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But some people were like, oh, okay, so is it new? And I'm like, yeah, it's new. Like, okay, what's, you know, you know, just to be careful, you should wait. You know what will happen? I was like, what do you mean? We never know what happened. Like, nothing's going to happen. Like,
yeah.
This is.
Let me enjoy my happiness.
Yeah, let me enjoy my happiness. This. Like, what are you talking about? You have to wait. And then, and then tragedy hits, you know?
Right.
And then this is the portion that's really, really my perspective on it.
Yeah.
I've never really shared that in details with anyone. So I don't know how other fathers, you know, would feel about a similar experience.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, right. And, I guess it's the fact that at this stage in time, your child is still just like a vision, right? It's not like you felt him. It's not like you touched him. It's not like you've seen him. You haven't really had time to create that connection.
Yeah.
That connection with the child. Yeah. So of course, when it happens, it's you know, it's devastating. It's sad and all of that stuff. But not on the same level as it is for the mother.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, so in terms of feeling, was yes, it's you know, it's very sad. But what was really killing me was seeing my wife and you know, in all the emotional distress that it was causing, right? And it's not like there was something that I could do about it to fix it, right? I'm a very like pragmatic person, so
yeah.
Whenever there's an issue between us, like, okay, let's sit down and discuss it, and then like, let's find
a solution,
a rational way, and a rational solution, or you know, something to get over it, to get through it. But in that case, there's nothing I could do. I mean, I was feeling some anger, not towards her, but just towards the fact that it happened, and we didn't really have an explanation as to why it happened.
Right.
We didn't really understood why it happened.
So was that like on a spiritual level or on a medical level? What do you mean?
No, it wasn't really on a spiritual level. It was more in terms of, like I said, I'm a really pragmatic and logical person. So just saying that, you know, it happened because it was... I don't know, God's will or something like that.
Right.
It's not where my my head or my mind would go at first.
Right.
Right. I would look to, okay, all right, so let's look at the facts. What is it that we can identify that might have been a cause to this, right? And where my mind was at is that if we can understand that, then you know, for the next one, we can maybe, you know, take the proper precautions or do better or know where exactly we can reduce the risk of things like that happening.
Right.
Right. And then, I mean, in the end, we did get that explanation, right? Mm-hmm. It has something to do with blood types and Rogam and all that stuff. But long story short, my wife has like a weird, super rare blood type,
right,
that can't really be identified right away by regular lab work.
Mm-hmm.
So for the longest while, even though she was told that she was A negative, she actually was only A. So they didn't know if she was a plus or a negative.
Right.
She was just a, right. But by default, they just put on paper that she was an A.
Right.
Anyway, so afterwards, you know, once we got that explanation and we knew that for the second one, all she had to do was to get a shot.
Mm-hmm.
To prevent the antibodies from attacking the embryo and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was kind of my relief in terms of understanding, okay, so now we know what happened.
Yeah.
And I know that for the next time, we're going to make sure that, you know, we get that shot and, you know, and all the medical professionals are implicated and they know the situation. So this should not happen again.
Right. Right.
Right.
So now you've got the solutions, you understand what happened, you guys decide, well, again, I know the story, but I want yours for testing. So baby number two, how did baby number two come about? Were you guys saying, okay, we're ready to try again, or was it like, how was it, how did it happen?
No, it was like, I think it was clear in my mind that, you know, we were ready to have a child. So, so it was really a question of like, okay, so medically speaking, how long do we have to wait until we try again?
I love it. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, so it wasn't long. So, I'm bad with timelines and stuff like that, but I think like 2-3 months later,
right,
I think, right, we were back at it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, we within a couple of weeks of trying, I think it was, you know,
yeah,
again, the seed is strong. What can I say?
I love it. And this time around, like, what was your feeling this time around? Because the first time was like high energy joy, but how were you, like, what was your mindset this time around?
This time around, it was, like, you know what, this time, you know, so the way I felt about it is like, this time I am not going to fail. This is how I felt, even though there's nothing really,
like, you guys didn't fail, really.
Practically do,
right?
But this is how I felt. I felt like, okay, so this time is the time, you know, like we know, you know, I'm going to make sure that she eats like 3 meals a day. She gets vitamins, she eats fruits, vegetables, she has meats, you know, like just to like make sure that we put all the elements in our, you know, on our side to make sure that we're successful this time around.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, I, like, you know, when she told me that she was pregnant again, it was like a yes, you know, like mission accomplished, you know, like we're back on this again.
Houston, there is no problem.
Yeah, basically. But you know, but this time around, we were more, more careful about announcing, you know, to everyone that we had lost the first one.
Right.
Right, because there's always this fear that you don't want to be in the same situation again. So we're like, okay, so maybe we'll listen to some of those advices that said you have to wait a bit just to make sure, because there's a high percentage of, you know, within this time frame of anyway. So, So at first we only told, I think my parents and my sister, and then once we got to, I think it's the, was it the 15-week mark or something like that, then we kind of announced it to the rest of the families and our friends and so on and so on.
Yeah. And it is like we were, baby was born in January. It's still a pandemic at that point, January 2022. I mean, we were in lockdown. We had curfew and all of that stuff, if I'm remembering correctly. So coming around, everything is going well. She's getting the shots. What was it like with the hospital? Because she told us you couldn't even come into the waiting room with her. Like, what was all of that like for you mentally at that point?
Interesting question. It was...
Well, first, okay, sorry. Yep. Before we get to the hospital, because she told us about, like, contractions and all of that, like, what was your mindset at when, like, okay, it seems like baby's ready to come? Or she started having those contractions, and it's like, you know, what was your mindset for that? What were you thinking?
My mindset about? For that?
Yeah.
Oh, like, I felt like I was...
It's a good question, like, because fathers are not often asked that question, right? Like, fathers are not asked how you were doing during that process. It's always how the mother is doing. So we don't really think about that side of things.
Yeah. It's very interesting. So I think, so when I realized that it was happening, and like, you know, I think I got into this like superhero mode.
Okay.
I felt that it was, you know, like it's, you know, it's my wife, my child, you know, she's going into labor, so I'm responsible, right? Like, I'm the superhero now. So I have to make sure that, you know, she gets to the hospital safely, that we take all the precautions, that we do all the stuff that we have to do. And at the same time, my wife is like a super nerd. People don't know that, but she's really a nerd. So she does a lot of research, and she prepares and she plans in advance and all that stuff. So she really put like all the elements in place for me to just, you know, grab and go type of thing.
Right.
And then at this point, it was like, okay, so you've done your part. Now it's for me to kind of lead. You know, and make sure that we get to where we're supposed to get.
Right.
And then if there's any, from this point on, if there's any unknown or anything that gets thrown at us, right, it's for me to tackle that on and take on that responsibility of figuring it out. So this was the mindset, right? You know, when you look at movies, often you see the father as the one that starts panicking and he doesn't know what to do, is going left and right. That's not what I felt. I felt like I knew exactly what I had to do. I had a purpose, I had a goal, and like I was ready for it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was like a challenge that I had been preparing for months now.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're tuning in for the first time, this is a part of a series that we're doing. It's called Black Fathers Month. And we are speaking to Cedric Charles Titus, who is a young father. And by young father, I do mean that the child is young, not that Cedric is necessarily young. We have to take a quick break. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Bring a whole lot of, a ton of ball. 50, y'all. But there's a ton of us, yeah. Cold in the winter, ready for summer ball. East side, west side, bringing you a ton of ball. Damn. North side, bring you a ton of ball. Damn. Worldwide, that's a ton of ball. Damn. East side, that's a ton of ball. Yeah. Bringing you a ton of ball. Buck is infinite. Ever. We could go 2,000 rounds. You heard about a ton. That's about 2,000 pounds. Wow. Ready to dump it on them. Wow. Just double pump it on them.
Through Tree Canada's National Greening Program, native tree seedlings are planted across Canada, creating a widespread impact. Planted trees provide habitat, prevent soil erosion, and reforest areas that have suffered tree loss due to pests and weather. Tree Canada performs 1, 2, and 5-year assessments to monitor tree survival and ensure the trees planted are on track to meet the forest cover goals of the site. To learn more or to get involved, go to treecanada.ca.
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and this month we are doing a special series dedicated to Black fathers. So we have with us Cedric Charles Titus, who was born in Montreal to Haitian parents and is now the proud father of a beautiful baby girl born this past January. Before we went to the break, Cedric told us about his mindset in terms of preparing for baby, and he mentioned that he felt like he was a bit of a superhero once it was clear that baby was ready to come into the world. So Cedric, you capped off with like getting your wife is very meticulous in everything that she does, so she kind of laid out the plan, the action plan, and as soon as you knew that it was time to like get ready to go to the hospital, et cetera, you just took the plan and ran with it. You put the plan into action. So tell us like your going to the hospital and how all of that played out, especially during this pandemic situation, how all of that played out in your mind.
Okay. So, So when we got to the hospital, they have this thing that they call, it's like a triage, right?
Right.
And it's a triage within like the maternity department. And it's something that I wasn't expecting. But we get there, and then we do like the regular intake forms. She asks questions about, medical condition, all that stuff. And then they're like, okay, so we're going to admit her into triage, and then a doctor is going to come and examine her to confirm that she's in labor, and then she'll be transferred over to delivery.
Right.
And then I'm like, okay, right. And that's really where the COVID thing hit me, right? Mm. Because as she was asking my wife to come inside, I was following her.
Of course.
In my mind, it's like, she's
where my wife go, I go.
Exactly. Where she goes, I go. She's having contractions. She needs me to, to rub her back in a certain specific way. And then, we have those breathing exercises. And then we have the medicine ball in the luggages. We have all this stuff prepared for the delivery, for the labor work and all of that stuff, right? Because everything had been planned out.
Yeah, exactly.
We had my speaker, and we had like a playlist. We were really prepared.
Yeah.
And then she walks in, and then the nurse just stops me. She's like, "No, only the mother." I'm like, "What do you mean?" Like, "Yeah, COVID regulation. Only her can go in there and wait for the doctor. You have to go in the waiting room."
Wow.
I was like, "Oh, okay." and there was really like a couple seconds. I'm like, "Do I make a scandal?" And then, just walking there anyway. And I was like, but then again, I like to say that I'm very rational and all of that. So
yeah, but there is always something. There's always something that will like remove all rationality from your brain, right?
Yeah,
and you realize in that moment, it's like, oh, okay, I could really become one of those dads right now.
Yes, I could. that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Like there was a classic showdown where the nurse was looking at me and I was looking back at her.
And you can hear the old cowboy music.
Exactly. I was like, "All right, I'm gonna let this one go." You have your phone, right? Okay, we call you, we're gonna text each other. Okay, we're good. She's like, "Yeah, I'll be good. I'm like, "Okay, all right." So I go and I sit in the waiting room, and then
Were there other fathers in the waiting room as well?
No. It was very early in the morning.
Okay.
We got there at like 5 a.m. on a Sunday morning.
Okay.
So even the hospital was felt really empty.
Okay.
Even as we walked in, there was nobody. Usually when you walk into the hospital, there's like
it's always 10 buzzing.
People that want to give you a mask and ask you questions. You have COVID and stuff. But like we walked in, there was nobody.
Wow.
So that's why I was referring to like the superhero, because we walked in, we didn't see nobody. And my wife was like, oh, what are we doing? I'm like, don't worry about it. Don't give us where we need to go. Follow me.
I like that.
Right. she's in there, she's in triage, and I'm in the waiting room. I'm alone there. There's no one else. And the interesting thing part, right? So she had started to have contractions at home. Mm-hmm. So by the time that we got to the hospital, the contractions were already intense.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a panic situation, but it was like a, you know, like, okay, this is happening. What do we need to do? Let's get, you know.
Yeah.
And then
you still want to be on your P's and Q's. You still want to be on the ball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So then we get, you know, she goes into triage and then I go in the waiting room. And then a couple hours later, this another couple arrives, and it was like the stark opposite of how my wife and I came in the sense that they were super relaxed. It didn't look like she was having any contraction. It was more like a planned delivery type of thing.
Okay.
So she was just coming. It's like, oh, hi, we have an appointment. Type of thing. I was like, oh, okay. All right. And then, you know, the dad, the same thing, they got separated. The dad came in the waiting room, sat down. And then, you know, he pulled out his phone and I could see that he was texting. I'm assuming that he was texting his lady.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I was trying to text my wife, but she wasn't responding.
Mm.
I was calling and she wasn't picking up the phone. So there was like, you know, I don't panic easy,
right?
But it was starting to get to that point where I was like, maybe I should have made a scandal to make sure I was in there.
Yeah, we all have our limits, right?
Yeah,
and we all like, I feel like, especially as men, we all have our boundary where we know, okay, I'm not going to get angry about this type of thing. And that develops over time as we age and stuff, because when we're younger, we'll probably get hot-headed about something. And then as we age, we're like, no. And then we all try to, I feel like just generally men try to like, we try to be cool because, especially black men, because if we get mad too easily, it's so easy for someone to call the cops and this, that, and the third. So,
yeah.
I'm like, this is a great story for me, because we don't hear this story of like, goddamn, like I'm actually feeling kind of anxious right now.
Yeah.
She's not responding. We had a plan. The plan was you go in the room, I text you, you text me back.
Yeah. So no responses, right? And then the nurse comes out and she's like, oh, she's doing great. You know, she's a strong woman, all of that stuff. Nah, the doctor, the first doctor saw her, and then we're just waiting for another doctor to come and confirm this and that. So I was like, okay, all right. So everything's under control then. She's like, yes, everything's under control. She's doing very well. And then she said, so we're going to send her to delivery department. But they have to do, because it was on Sunday morning. So they didn't have a lot of staff overnight. So she was explaining to me that they're going to wait for the staff to change to the day staff before they send her there.
Right.
Right. So at this point, it was like, I think it was around 6 or 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to happen at 8 a.m. So it was like another hour to wait, and then I'll be with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
So I was okay, all right. So I'll go back, sit down, thinking that, okay, everything's under control. You know, the stress level is starting to need to go down a bit.
Yeah.
Right. And then and then I hear a scream.
Your wife was screaming.
Hey, hold on. I heard the scream. I wasn't sure if it was my wife.
Okay, so you heard a scream. Okay.
So we heard a scream, right? So I looked at him. He looks back at me, and he kind of shrugs as if like, I don't know. It's not my wife. I'm like, oh, man. So that was my wife screaming just now. And then, and then I just kind of like raised my head, like kind of look left and right for some type of indication as to whether or not I should start panicking. And then I see the nurse come out running. She's like, Cedric. I'm like, yeah, that's me. Okay, come, quick. I'm like, oh,
I can only imagine that is like, your brain just goes to worst case scenario right away.
Yeah, immediately worst case scenario. Like, I'm like, at this point, I'm like, what happened? You know, and I'm like, I knew I should have made a scandal. And then grab all the luggage, run in there, and like, and basically, that's when I realized that while I was in there chilling, like she was basically in almost active labor, you know, for like 3-4 hours. And mm-hmm. You know, I could see like the pain all over her face, like. Her handbag was like had fallen on the side, on the other side of the bed, and the phone like had come out. So that's why she couldn't even reach her phone.
She was right? In so much pain.
All the time that was, yeah, she was in so much pain, and it was on the floor. She couldn't like go and get it. She had to stay in the chair. Anyway, that's when I realized that okay, all right, so like she's been going through this basically alone.
Yeah.
Well, the plan was for me to be right next to her during that time, during, you know, the difficult time. There's this. Okay, so I'm going to say this, and it also comes back to, you know, the first time that we found out that she was pregnant and everything. It's like there's a sense of that. You're kind of powerless in a sense. Right, because you're not carrying the baby. You don't have that deep physical and emotional connection with the baby. So you're kind of like on the outside, even though you're sharing, you know, that deep connection with the mother. You don't have you have the sense that there's not much that you can do, even if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Right. And then this I guess this feeling of being powerless kind of follows you. And to that point, it kind of was the culmination of all that, you know, feeling of being powerless.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember this point in time where, it was, okay, so how do I, channel all that energy that had like accumulated for all these months inside,
yeah,
you know, at that point. To be honest, when I saw her in the room and I saw that she's been going through so much pain and all that stuff by herself, I felt extremely angry at that very moment.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a PTSD type of thing from when she had the first miscarriage, right? To that same point where like all of this is happening to her. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to be there to, you know, I'm supposed to be the protector. I'm supposed to be the one handling everything for her. And, yeah. And then again, I was in a situation where I was completely powerless.
Wow. Yeah.
But from that point on, things happened so quickly. I don't think I've really had time to really process that anger into anything concrete, right?
Right.
I was kind of still in superhero mode, thinking that okay, like set your anger aside for now,
yeah,
and then focus on the goal here,
yeah.
And this is really the mindset that I, you know, that I had at the time.
Yeah.
Um, yeah, and then after that, it was really, you know, it was kind of the time for delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, do you want to go into details of the
absolutely, man? It's your perspective. Like, we had Rayma's perspective, and that's okay. But we want your perspective. That's why we're here today.
All right. Okay. So okay. So then, like I said, so I get to through the triage. I get to see my wife. It's you know, in the situation that she was, in pain and everything. Like, all of her stuff was over the floor and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a nurse that comes. She's like, okay, listen, we need to get her to delivery. However, it's not a long walk, but she only has 2 minutes between her contractions. Okay. And at this point, her contractions are so intense, she can't walk.
Wow.
Right? And then she pulls out the wheelchair. And she's like, you have to put her on the wheelchair. And I'm like, okay. So I'm about to, you know, to help her lift her up and put her on the chair. And she has another contractions. And then, you know, like, and then I hear the scream again. The first one that made me panic and, you know, mm-hmm. and run into the into triage. And then she's done and she's like, okay, now. So I take her, I put her on a chair, and then the nurse says, follow me. And then it was this tiny nurse, she must have been like 5'1".
Wow.
And she takes my wife and she starts sprinting to the hospital with her. And I'm like, oh wow. So now I have to grab all the luggages everything. Because we overpacked, because we're, you know, we're planning everything.
Yeah.
And I'm just running behind her. You know?
Wow.
And then as this lady is running through the hospital, she's like throwing papers at other nurses. She's like, yeah, you take off this, 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 and that. And then throwing papers as she's running. And so we finally get to the other room where they're actually going to do the delivery, right? And it was like the opposite of where she had been. It was like a nice large room. It seemed like it was super high tech, like brand new. Like, everything seemed like it was brand new.
Wow. Okay.
So we're like, okay. So it was like, all right. So I'm feeling like, okay, like, you know, this is something, yeah. This is a more comfortable environment. This is something where I can kind of like take charge again, try to, you know, control things again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the new nurse comes in. She seemed like a very sweet lady. She's like, hi guys, how you doing? Hi, mommy. You're doing very well. And she's like super happy.
Perfect
and jolly,
personality,
right?
For this kind of job.
Yeah. And you have to remember, it's like, it's the new staff. So they just started, right?
Yeah. They're also fresh.
And my wife is probably the first patient that she saw for the day.
Right.
And then I wish. And then she looks at my wife. She's like, yes, you can do this. And then. She has another contraction, and then she releases one of them screams that made the whole hospital tremble.
So she went Super Saiyan.
Yeah, she went Super Saiyan on that one. And then that sweet lady, the sweet nurse that was there, she just panicked. She said, okay. But it's okay, mom. You're doing great. You can do this. And my wife is like, no, I can't. So she's like, this poor nurse is like, oh, okay. Well, I'm gonna let you guys settle, and I'll be back in a few minutes. So she goes away. My wife is like, fuck that shit. She takes off her robe, throws it on the floor. She's like, Cedric, where's the shower? I'm like, oh, it's right there. Kicks down the door, walks in, and she's still wearing her clothes. She's down under the shower, and she's like, I want hot water. I want warm water, Cedric. I'm like, okay, I turn it on. And then I was still dressed, so I kind of like step back so that she can, you know, let the water go on her. She was putting on her stomach and everything. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, oh, rub my back. I'm like, but you're still in the shower. Rub my back. Okay,
this sounds like directed from a movie.
Yo.
I almost wish you had a GoPro on your head to record the whole thing.
Ah, Hey, so I'm in there rubbing her back while she's showering herself. And then so she comes out, she grabs a towel and everything. And then the nurse comes back. And then all detail that I forgot. So when she was still in the triage, mm-hmm. The nurse called in advance saying that she was bringing my wife, mm-hmm. And they also said that she wants to have pain management. Mm-hmm. So basically, that's the epidural.
Right.
So as soon as my wife comes out of the shower, and then she sees the nurse, she looks straight at her and say, "Okay, so when am I getting my epidural?" And the nurse is like, sure. The doctor has to come in and examine you first. But yes, we can get you your epidural. And then my wife goes, "I was told I was getting an epidural. I want my epidural." So the nurse is like, okay, but first I need to put an IV in your arm." And then my wife just extends her arm and taps on her arm, and she goes, "Yes, okay, go ahead, put it in." And it's like, "Okay, but wait, you have to get on the bed." It took 1 second. My wife was on the bed with her arm extended, waiting, asking for that IV so she can get her damn epidural. Because at this point, the pain was so intense, she had no choice but to scream, right?
Right.
And she's not, and I've never known her to be a screamer or to, even when she gets hurt, she doesn't really scream or cry or anything like that. Like she always felt like she was a pretty, she was able to endure the pain fine, but that was like way past the threshold. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like the environment in there, in the sense that even though I was, I think we were both stressed at some level. Mm-hmm. But in the way that she was communicating her pain through her screams, it was stressing everyone else out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm not going to lie, it was a little bit satisfying, because every time she had a scream and I could see the nurse panic, I was like, "Yeah, that's my wife. Yes. Yes. Get her damn epidural."
Get her what she wants, damn it.
Yeah. So, and then the doctor finally comes in, and then he's like, "Okay," she's like, "Okay," she examined her. She's like, "Well, listen, you're already 8.5 centimeters dilated," mm-hmm. right? And usually they actually start to push at 10 centimeters,
right?
And then she tells my wife, "Listen, is that your first one?" She, "Yes, it's the first one." It's like, "Well, you're doing great. I mean, you got to this point without any pain medication or anything. Like you're almost there. You're like 85% there."
Right.
Right. So you want to keep going, and then we're just, I'm gonna proceed, wait for you to get to 10 centimeters, and then just start pushing. And then my wife goes, "I want my epidural." So that's the doctor, right? And so this, and then there was like a good 30 seconds of them just looking at each other in silence. And I'm looking at the nurse, I'm looking at the doctor, looking at my wife. And then I'm looking at the nurse that's doing exactly the same thing I'm doing. We're kind of just waiting to see what's going to happen.
Again, like another cowboy showdown.
Another cowboy showdown. Yeah. And then again, the doctor's like, "Fine, okay, we can have the epidural." Okay. Which normally never happens, right?
Yeah, I find that to be fascinating, that the doctor was like, "Let's try and do this without," because oftentimes, they want to push for epidurals, they want to push for C-sections, they want to push for all these extra procedures, because, like it or not, vivre pas, there's an incentive, there's a financial incentive to having these kind of procedures added on.
Yeah.
Yeah, we spoke to a doula several months ago, I believe back in November or October last year, and that was one of the things that she was saying to us. It's like, there's a lot of violence obstetric, so obstetrics violence that occurs with mothers, specifically Black mothers, Black and Indigenous mothers. So I'm like, oh, this is a nice story to hear, because at least we know that there's at least one doctor who's like reluctant to like push the epidural and push you know, all the other nurses. But yes, please continue.
Yeah. So after the showdown, the doctor is like, okay, fine, you can get your epidural. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so then again, she leaves, and then that sweet nurse is stuck with us now,
right?
Trying to survive. And then the second doctor who's gonna do the epidural comes in, right? It's like, okay, my name is this and that, we're gonna do this and that. Okay, let me just get set up here. So he has like the little station that he brought with him.
Yeah.
And I see he pulls out a syringe, and then the that thing must have been like close to 30 centimeters long.
Wow.
And I was like, that's when I realized, like, oh wow. So this is what it is if you do, they're actually gonna, you know, inject that into her spine.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't realize that all of you know, up and on. I never actually ever looked it up what it actually was.
Yeah.
I always thought that it was just the name of the medication and whatever, and it was just injected through IV. I didn't realize it was going to be in her spine.
Yeah.
And she was having those really big contractions. So it was a little stressful in the sense that I had to make sure that she wasn't moving, right? Mm. And at this point, just being like an outside participant and letting the, you know, the medical staff do the work was insufficient at this point where I realized that there was a certain risk level.
Yeah.
So you
had to be an active team player in at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I made sure, like, you know, I was holding her arms while she was sitting. And there was this constant eye contact. You know, it's like you look at me, don't look at anything else. And then you make sure that, you know, you don't move, so that even if you have a contraction, like, you just have to like tough it out and not move at all while he's doing his thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then so he does the thing. This was very professional in the sense that it you know, he did it very quickly. So now he's done with the epidural. Irma is back on her back, and then he starts like packing up his stuff, but he doesn't say anything. He packs up his stuff. And then he kind of walks back to the door, and before he's about to leave, and he's like, okay, guys, so we did the epidural, right? But just for information, it may take up to 15 to 20 minutes to kick in. And he says that, he said, if it works. And then he walks away. And then we're both like, wait, what? Like, what just happened?
Listen, if you have a kid again, you need to have a GoPro on your chest or on your head, because it's as if it's a movie. It's playing out like a movie. Like, why would a doctor not just say that as he's packing up his stuff? Like, the way you're describing it, it's as if he was like, you know what? I heard these screams. I heard her tell the people about the epidural and this, that, and the third. I'm going to be as far out of this room as possible before I tell them that, oh, actually, it might not work, and it's going to take a little while to kick in. Bye! Like a cartoon, you see a puff of smoke, and he runs away.
Yeah, basically. So the doctor says that and leaves, and then we look at it, my wife and I, we look at each other like, are you serious? And then she has another big contraction. It probably like this one, she's like screaming, and then she's holding my hand and then crushing the bone in my hand. And then she looks at the nurse and she said, "I want to push." Wow. And then the nurse is like, no, don't push. The nurse grabs the emergency button and she starts knocking the button. She's like, "Doctor, we need a doctor right now. We need a doctor now." She's ready to push. And then she's holding Rima's hand. She's like, "No, don't push. Hold it. Don't push. And then there's another nurse that walks in and she goes, "Is everything okay in here?" And then the sweet nurse goes, "No, it's not okay. We need the doctor now."
Oh my God.
So doctor finally comes in, and doctor walks in like all relaxed, as if like, yeah, okay, like the lady that insisted on getting her epidural, right?
Right.
And then she goes, and then she, you know, she looks at Rima's, you know, to examine her to see where she at in terms of dilation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then as she opens up her leg to look at it, I heard a pop, and then her water just comes out rushing all over the doctor. Right.
Another
and
like
the doctor like realized. Yeah, I was like the foot to spool. And she yeah. So doctor realized at this point, like, okay, like this is happening right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was that must have been like maybe three or four minutes after she got the epidural. That was going to kick in 15, 20 minutes if it worked.
Mm-hmm.
So doctor starts giving instruction to everyone. Okay, you do this, you do that, you give her this amount of this and that, you know? And then she tells me, okay, so you're gonna hold her leg, right? And then the nurse was on the other side holding the other leg.
Right.
So
Before you continue, yeah, we do have to take a quick commercial break, because this move, this on this episode of ER, we do have to take a quick break. We are talking to Sadiq Charles Titus, and he's telling us the story of his first child's birth as part of the series that we're doing this month for Black Fathers. But keep it locked. We're going to be right back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Many times that this time would be the last time that I see you cry, but I kept trying and I caught myself lying a few times. I mean, my pride took me for a ride with no one else beside me, but me acting silly and so blind that I couldn't see. And yes, behind me, no floors, I'm free falling and gots to trust the process, but there are 6 million ways to grow, gots to choose one. Like today, I wanted to run a 5K, but my app decided to fail me. It's what the screen displayed, and now I'm just kind of lay. Staring at the hour encrusted in my black mirror. As my blues grew darker, you were right there by the corner. You asked me to come back home and reconnect with yourself and share a meal with your loved ones. But I was too busy cocooning and forgot what was a butterfly, bouncing freely like echo in a chamber. From loud music to clock ticking, I couldn't hear what was...
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and this month we are celebrating Black Fathers by speaking to a variety of Black Fathers at different stages of fatherhood. Tonight we have Cedric Charles Titus, who was born in Montreal to Haitian parents and is the proud father of a beautiful baby girl born this past January. Before the break, he has been telling us over the course of this evening about his experience as a father, and I feel like I'm watching an episode of ER because he's describing to us the whole process of the birth of his child. And right now, where we ended off was the doctor instructing him and the nurse on how to help Rima, his wife, to push the baby, basically. Yeah, Cedric, man, thank you so much. This is so much fun for me. I'm living vicariously through your story. You should definitely consider storytelling because you're really good at it. The details are very beautiful. So, what happened now? You're told to hold Rayma's legs. You and the nurse are working together, and the doctor is ready. You know, after she got, the doctor got, like, sprayed with the amniotic fluid.
Womb juice.
being all sarcastic, like, oh, yeah, you know, I know better, and she's only 8.5 centimeters. So, yeah, what happened next?
Yeah. So I'm holding your leg, and the nurse is holding the other leg, and then the doctor is just, you know, kind of giving direction as to what everyone is supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then she asks Rima to start pushing. And then before all of that, I told myself that I was not going to look. I didn't want to look. Right, I didn't want to see it happen because I've seen videos on YouTube before,
mm-hmm.
and it was really gruesome. So right. I was like, "Nah, you know what? I don't want to be one of those that's gonna stand in there and then just pass out,
right,
or something like that." I'm like, "Okay," so I looked away, and then I can hear her push, with the screams and everything. She's pushing. And then next thing I know, I have my two eyes down there looking at everything that's happening. there was a switch in my brain at some point. It's like, my brain's like, no, you have to look.
I didn't even
realize it.
Yeah.
I need to know. I need to see this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in there looking, and then I can see the head of the baby that's starting to pop out.
Yeah.
And like, then at this point, I'm like rushed with emotions. I think I even started crying, you know, amazed by the beauty of the birth of my baby girl.
Mm-hmm.
So basically as she's pushing, you could see the head starts to pop out. And then when she stops pushing, the head kind of goes back inside. Right.
Okay.
So it's really like a, you know, like she's pushing,
like
it comes out.
War.
Every time it comes out a little bit more. Yeah, it's like a tug of war.
Right.
And then at some point the whole head is out.
Yeah.
Right. And then the doctor and I noticed at the same time because we're looking. And realized that the
umbilical cord.
Umbilical cord is wrapped around her neck.
Wow.
All right. And then immediately the doctor asked my wife to stop pushing and to hold it. And I think probably the danger there was that if the head goes back inside, maybe the cord is gonna wrap tighter around her neck and
right.
stuff. Right. So she's asking you to hold. And then she unwraps the cord from around the baby's neck, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she asks my wife, okay, so on the next contraction, you gotta push. And then my wife says, I'm still on that same contraction. And she's like, okay, push. And then she starts pushing again. And then we hear a pop noise. Pop.
Okay.
And then juice and room liquid blood just explodes and flies into the doctor's face like a that was crazy. And then the baby gets ejected. gets ejected, and doctor catches the baby with one hand almost, and then she pulls her up, and then my baby girl just raises her arm to the sky and then start screaming.
like a Spartan
war cry, and that's how she was born. And it was, you know, at that moment I think I even said that out loud. I said, wow, this was the most beautiful and disgusting moment I've ever witnessed in my life.
Yeah. And tell us the first time that, like, you had baby in your arms. Like, what were you going through emotionally, mentally? Because now, you know, now the powerlessness of, like, not being able to actually be, like, actually do something with baby, that powerlessness, because baby used to be inside somebody, you know, I'm assuming, I'm hoping, started to dissipate because now you actually have the person in your hand. So, like, what was going through your head at that point?
So at this point, it's like, so she comes out, and the first thing that hit me is that in all those videos that I've seen previously on YouTube of things coming out, it's like when they come out, they're all like covered in goo and blood and all that stuff. They're you know, they're pretty much disgusting. No, let's be honest here. They're pretty much disgusting when they come out. But this one, she when she came out, she was clean.
Right.
Like, there wasn't anything on her. Like, they didn't have to, like, wipe her down or anything like that. Like, this was crazy. And one detail I forgot to mention is that, so from the time that she started to push, from the time that she was out, there was only 5 minutes.
Right.
Right. And usually that, for a first time mother, these that time can range from hours to, I guess, multiple hours, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, so sometimes days. 5 minutes. That's one of the reason why she was so clean and stuff. And then, anyway, so the nurse, they do the thing, they take measurements and all that stuff, and then she hands it to me, and then it's like the feeling that I got when I first hold her, when I held her for the first time is incredible. Immediately, you feel, I felt rushed with love. Like, there was this tiny human that I've been waiting for so long, and then she was right there, and then, like, instantly I felt that, you know, the connection that I was longing for with this tiny human was right there, right in front of me. Right. Right? It was, I finally get to physically feel, you know, what it is to be a father, I guess. And then you kind of forget about all the hardship that you had to go through, or that she had to go through to get there.
Right.
And then it just opens up a brand new world of possibility in terms of creating that relationship, or that link with that tiny little human that you're holding in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that feeling of being a superhero finally kind of really meant something at this point, right? Because it was mission accomplished, you know.
Yeah.
We're able to get to that goal that we had been working for so long.
Yeah. Oh, but, like, if you ever decide to start writing, you should write that whole story down, because it would make a great episode on, like, one of those medical doctor shows, because all the dramatics and the theatrics of it is, like, on point. And now baby's been with you for a few months, still home, still working from home. So how has your routine kind of modified or changed? Because now you have another person. First you were two, now you're three. How has that modified now since bringing baby home?
First we had to, like, to change the whole setup of the house to accommodate for the baby.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of preparation that was done beforehand, to make sure that then again, because my wife is, like, a, you know, a nurse, so everything is prepared, everything has been, like, thoroughly researched and reviewed and peer reviewed by this and that, so she look at stuff online. So we only have, like, a you know, a proper setup for everything. So it does change. It kind of changes everything, right? Because now everything you do in the house is, you have to think about the baby, right? Yeah. About what is best for the baby.
Yeah.
So even, you know, even when we eat and stuff like that, because of breastfeeding, we have to think about what may affect the baby and so on and so on.
Right. You don't want to eat food that's too spicy because it might change the milk, the breast milk, and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, for all the fathers out there, if you do get a chance, taste the breast milk.
Okay.
It is actually very good.
Okay.
It's sweet. I didn't expect it. It's actually very sweet. I understand why babies like it so much.
Anyway, it's a side
thing. Yeah, but okay. So maybe we can get into something that's more that's deeper here.
Okay.
In a sense that yes, you do all the preparation, and then you might kind of modify your lifestyle and all that stuff for the baby. That's normal stuff. That's what everybody does. Maybe what's interesting to touch on is the whole thing about parenting, mm-hmm. right? So the first thing that we realize is that no matter the amount of book that you read or the amount of videos that you watch or how much you think that you know,
yeah,
right? The first thing that you realize is that you don't know jack shit.
Exactly.
And the sooner you can come to the realization that you don't know, when it's okay not to know because you're a first-time parent,
mm-hmm.
this is when you can start to really move on, and adopt that more constructive mind in terms of figuring out what is best for your baby, mm-hmm. rather than panicking about what you might not be doing or what you might be doing wrong.
Right. Yeah, you can't really, each child is so different that you can't really follow because a book says step one is this, step two is this, step three is this. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the order. And that doesn't mean that those are the steps that you're going to be taking at all, because everybody is different.
Exactly.
You can use it as a guideline, but not, it can't be like a blueprint.
Exactly. Yeah. And then even when it comes to, and then because you're in that stage where, it's kind of unknown, but you do want to do like the best possible for your child.
Yeah.
You ask yourself questions about everything.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, when I was holding her, and light, let's say, you know, the sunlight is coming through the window, and then it flashes over her face. Like I didn't see her pupil
dilate
or get smaller. Okay. Right. So then I'm thinking, oh wait, is there something wrong with her? Right. And then I start to look it up on the internet, and then make some research, you know, find some articles, and it seemed to indicate that there may be some type of neurological issue. With her and her brain and development and all that stuff,
right?
And you become then. This is for me, right? So it creates this type of anxiety where you're like, okay, so do I have to act now? Like, should I take her to the ER right now to make sure that it doesn't, you know, degenerate into something, you know, more dangerous, or, you know, like, should I take action right now?
Yeah.
So then you start speaking to other family members. They're like, oh yeah, it's normal. And then the other one's going to be like, no, that's not normal. So you kind of, you don't know exactly where to stand.
There's no cookie cutter mold that you can follow. It's like,
yeah.
One person will give you one piece of information, but another person gives you something completely opposite. So you really, at the end of the day, you don't know what you're actually supposed to do, because your research is not showing up like scientific data. It's not showing like, okay, 9 out of 10 times, if this happens, it's like, no, it's one, then it's yes, then no, then maybe, then probably, then if, then
yeah,
if this, then that. It's not consistent.
Yeah, it's exactly. And then, so in the end, she had an appointment with her doctor. Well, it wasn't even a doctor. It was a nurse. And I asked that to the nurse. I'm like, you know, like, she doesn't seem to be responding to lights. And the nurse is like, kind of make this weird face. Like, what are you talking about? And then she examined her and she's like, no, the response is fine. And as she's doing, I can see that her eye is not, like, the pupil in her eyes is not, like, moving as she's passing the light in her face. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the nurse, like, what are you talking about? Like, are we looking at the same thing? And right. She's like, no. It's because you have to look at the response in the other eye. So all along, I was simply not looking at her the right way.
Right.
In the sense that at this age, if you pass light in one eye, then the other one is going to respond, not the one that's, you know, not the eye where you're flashing the light.
Wow, that's interesting.
See? And so that's why I say that you really have to, you know, get to the realization that you really don't know, like, unless, I mean, you know, you have medical training and you already know all of those things.
Right.
There is some limitation to the amount of Google research that you can do, right? Because in none of those research said that you have to look at the response in the other eye, not the one that you're flashing the lights on.
Wow.
So just to give an example of how, you know, nerve-wracking you can get.
Yeah.
And now I understand when I used to hear things saying that, you know, having a baby is really like the ultimate test for a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt that at that moment, because when it's just the two of you, you can sit down and rationalize things and then find solutions.
Yeah.
You know, talk about emotions and all of that stuff. But when it comes to your child, it's like,
it's a whole different ball game.
It's a whole different ball game. And then just an example like the one I just gave. So as I'm voicing my concerns about, you know, her not responding to the light the way that she should be,
mm-hmm.
On the other side, my wife might be already anxious about, you know, something else related to breastfeeding.
Right.
And then when it gets into a situation where she's like, why are you adding stress on top of my stress I already have? Are you trying to tell me that there's something wrong with my child?
Right.
And it's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just, you know, expressing my concern as a parent for the, you know, because I just want to make sure my daughter is fine. I want the well-being of my daughter. So, and in that moment, I understand how it can really make or break a couple, this dynamic of, you know, of two parents dealing with their own emotions in regard to their fitness as a parent of mm-hmm. taking care of the child. I don't know if I word that in a way that makes
but like
sense.
Also, like, you're now that baby's out, you're still having two completely different experiences in terms
yes.
of at this early stage to be parenting, and it's gonna be two completely different experiences throughout your entire lives, because you are not only the father, but you are Cedric who has this life experience and this way of looking at things, and she is Rayma and she is the mother, and she has this life experience and this way of looking at things. So you're gonna see things with baby that she might not prioritize or notice at all, because she has things that you're probably not prioritizing or experiencing at all. So I can see where the conflict will come, because it's like she sees you as adding something, but it's like, no, this is just my experience and my perspective, and you are valid as a father in voicing those concerns, as she is valid as the mother in voicing her concerns. Mm-hmm. We do have to take another quick break. So just in case you're tuning in for the first time, we are continuing our series talking to Black fathers for the entire month of June. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
pour le jouer en tant qu'artiste. La terre n'est pas j'en bas, et le roi divin pas mes lavis. Et non, c'est justice ou son activiste.
C'est anti-monde tombé, fait les politiciens prennent roulé. Bah, vivez nous à Glabi, y'a rien la vie n'est pas aussi. Majorité moun pas travail, pas forcé anesthésié, peuple à nan goutaille. Il pas plat pour dénoncer, défoncer sac bêtisé. Qui pas comprendre qui wall yo, c'est pour élever les frisottes, cap dormi. Depuis nan Guinée, Bonègue et Deneg, Jafrika alertine, ouvert jour, ouvrez oreilles. Pas chita nan misé, écarté toute ville au pays. Facebook, Twitter, ou pas ouais nous tout nan day. Ça fait mal les maps gâtés, y'a un petit moun en palimpé, cap groom. Mais pour aller à l'hôpital, j'ai sans relever, sans transport, sur un rubrique blessé qui fatigué. Dégoûté à fois des journalistes cap constitué. Pour quelques dollars pas représenté, forme la société. La justice, tout pas garantie, même sous handicapé. Frem.
Yes, 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 we're back, we're back, we're back. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominic Ferguson, and we are continuing our Black Father series with Cedric Charles Titus, who is a Montreal born in Montreal to Haitian parents, is now 36 years old, married, proud father of a beautiful baby girl born this past January. He grew up in Aylmer, a small city close to Ottawa, currently known as Gatineau, and moved back to Montreal for school. He completed his studies at HEC Montreal and is currently working as a senior business analyst for TELUS. Cedric, I am so grateful that you agreed to come on, and I'm grateful for your honesty and your vulnerability in sharing your story, the story of the birth of your first baby girl. And it's coming to the end of the show. I just wanted to ask you, what are maybe a few key things in your experience that you think you can share with someone who is becoming a new father?
Well, first thing I would say, and I'll just repeat something I said early on, is to accept the fact that you don't know everything, and there's no way that you can know everything.
Yeah.
Second thing I would say is more than ever, when there's a third human, when there's a child involved in your relationship, you have to create those. You have to be open about, I would say, how you feel with your significant other, in order to make sure that you create that strong connections, that would give you the tools to address the challenges that will come, because there will be some for sure.
Right.
There's really no amount of preparation that would really prepare you for what it actually is in real life. Mm-hmm. Parenting, at least from my perspective, at first seemed like it was going to be not necessarily easy, but I felt that this is something that I would have a good handle on.
Right.
And as I'm going through it, I realize, how can I say that? Some of the limitation that there is to what you can do as a father, especially when the child is very young.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, only being months old, it's like one of the first things I realized is that I don't have a breast. Mm-hmm. I don't have milk coming out of my breast. Right?
Yeah.
So even though I want to be the father, this is my child, let me take her and put her to sleep.
Right.
Nah. Like, mm-hmm. until she gets that milk, she's going to cry and make your life miserable.
Right.
So So at first, it's really a support role that you have as a father, to try, to make it as comfortable as possible for the mother.
Yeah.
Because she will be doing the brunt of the work.
For a good chunk of time.
Definitely a good chunk of it, right? But it doesn't stop you from being involved. It doesn't stop you from being around. It doesn't stop you from offering help, and making things
as comfortable as possible,
yeah. Right? I don't have that much advice to give because I'm fairly new at this.
Yeah, but still, I think it's important because a lot, like, this is not, because when it comes to pregnancy, and I have a child as well, and I, do research, talk to people that I know, and the majority of the information is always centered around the mother. It's about the mother, the preparation for the mother, but oftentimes we get forgotten. Fathers get forgotten because of that, because the mother is actually doing the physical aspect of carrying the child, birthing the child, and then for depending on how long the mother is willing to breastfeed, a year or 2 years, breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. So a lot of emphasis is put on the side of the mother. So, but I think it's really important to get that perspective of, like, okay, the dad, this is what the dad can do on his side as well. It's almost like we have to intuitively figure it out. But the truth of the matter is we play a vital role in the creation of the child. And even though we are not carrying the child, we can actively support our partner, the mother of our child, moving forward. And I think that we need to acknowledge that fathers are just as important as mothers when it comes to parenting and when it comes to making sure that child is safe and ready in this world that we're living in. Cedric, thank you so much. This has been awesome to talk to you. I think we're going to have to bring you on in maybe a year or two again to get an update and get some more stories from you. Thank you very much for participating in this Black Fathers, dedication to Black Fathers Month. I wish you all the best with you, your daughter and your family. And hopefully we're like, this pandemic just becomes like non-existent and we can find a new, I don't want to say go back to normal. I want to say find a new normal, because obviously what we were doing before wasn't working. So let's find a new way of doing it. I mean, come on, we've been in lockdown for two years in March. Like, something ain't working if we have to be in lockdown for that long. That's how I feel about that. Thank you for joining us this evening. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And ladies and gentlemen, this is part of our series, Black Fathers, celebration of Black Fathers for the month of June. And we just spoke to Cedric Charles Titus, whose baby was just born this January, so it's still fresh. We do have to sign off because it's the end of the show. Show's got to end. Join us every Tuesday evening from 7 to 8:30 p.m. here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name has been Kim Dominic Ferguson, and you have been listening to Soul Perspectives. Have a good night. Is that sunshine in the rain?
September 17th at Bell Center. Get tickets now at carolgmusic.com.
Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of Dear Jackie, a feature documentary by Henri Pardo. The film opens on June 17 in 4 theaters in Montreal: Cinéma Public, Cinéma du Musée, Cinémathèque Québécoise, and Cinéma Moderne, with the director and special guests in attendance at select screenings. Dear Jackie poetically tells the story of one of the oldest black communities in Canada, Montreal's Little Burgundy, by way of a cinematic letter to Jackie Robinson, the first black man to break the color barrier in professional baseball. It also masterfully connects history to the present by challenging the myth of a post-racial society. This release is co-presented by Desta Black Youth Network, Tyndale St. George's Community Center, Canteen Bergs, and Makisia Solo. For more information and tickets, visit cinemapolitica.org. We hope to see you there. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
You know, it's the boy Dash all the way from Grenada, and you tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM.